Now we're going to do something a little different tonight, and I want to prepare you for it because we want to provide a brand new tape this evening. And in other words, as progress goes along and I get new materials and everything, because when I'm invited to talk someplace, I can only talk maybe for an hour and a half or 2 hours, and I cover just summary material of the usual. But once in a while, as material accumulates, we try to prepare a whole tape on the subject. Then we can refer people to it, because it's not often I'd have the advantage to talk for 10 or 15 hours. And so many things you would not know about. But I'm not going to talk for 15 tonight, just 14. So for the first hour, first 55 minutes, I'm going to try to outline to you a series of discoveries, and then we'll let you stand up and get your circulation going again and wake up. And then I'm going to add some material on the Book of Mormon to a tape that's already available. So it'll be an hour and a half long tape. That'll give 2.5 hours of new discoveries concerning the Book of Mormon. And then we'll give you another new tape tonight. So there's going to be 3 things added tonight to the tape list, most of which have not been provided before. So you've been selected for this. And I hope you'll bear with me then as we try to accommodate that this evening. Therefore, this evening, I want to tell you a little bit about a series of discoveries which, as they materialize and become available, provide for the LDS individual confirmation of the restoration. Things have been happening the last several decades, and really since the dispensation of the fullness of times was ushered in 140 years ago or more. But around the world, discoveries are being made that have singular importance for the LDS individual. 800 Christian churches do not teach about the spirit world. They do not teach doctrines concerning the Heavenly Mother or the immortality of the soul, the imperishable intelligence of the soul. They don't teach those things. But what is being found throughout the world, and you're going to find that this stretches from here to China, is confirmation that the prophet Joseph Smith, in the legacy that he left us, in the profound, thorough, comprehensive restoration, he covered the salient doctrines taught by the Jews and by individuals before the time of Christ and in the centuries just following, lost, totally lost. Joseph Smith could not have conjured these things up in his mind whatsoever, not in the continuity, not in the solemnities and the breadth and the broth that he was able to accomplish in his short life. I want to start with Turfan, China. What was found in Turfan, China? Back in the 20s and right about the turn of the 30s there were 4 expeditions, German, Russian, Japanese, and French, who went into the area 90 miles north of the Great Silk Trade Route. There at Turfan, they found a series of discoveries. Manuscripts of the 3rd century, an individual by the name of Mani. This Mani was involved with a Jewish background, and he and his father apparently were part of a group who were coeval with the beginnings of Christianity, perhaps part of the dispersion when both Christians and Jews were driven from the country of Palestine 68 to 70 AD. And so in China, Turfan, China, we have now the Manichaean discoveries. I'm going to give you just a little bit of detail on the Mani material so you can see what it might involve, because at this moment there are no available books in English covering the discoveries of Mani. I could not refer to you anything except Persian and Iranian texts with a little bit of English footnotes. In the year 216 when he was born, the Orthodox Church of his day had begun to tamper, eliminate, and remove teachings concerning the paradigm of all things, the wedding robe, the temple consecrations, the doctrine of the Mother in Heaven, the preexistence, the council in Heaven. And so in the doctrines of Mani, we're finding such things as how Jesus Christ, the first great and divine being, descended into hell to combat the devils. Important to the LDS person, we just added the scripture a year ago. Entire details concerning that descent, what was accomplished and what occurred there. The Mother of Heaven is discussed in the doctrines of Mani. The living spirit of the first man and the name of Father as being man, found in the pearly great price, man of holiness, in these teachings of Mani. Also discusses the consciousness, the addition of the soul, the breathing into the life of the body of Adam, and many of the things concerning the episode in the garden. Primarily, however, as Mani tried to introduce many of these things in his day, the same thing happened to him that happened to another young man 1900 years later, who tried to introduce it to the world. He was killed, and his doctrines were considered to be heresies. And so they crept into the Orient, and for 800 years after most of Christianity had lost these salient doctrines, they were found in China. Then in the 1930s, an individual was offered a whole series of documents in Egypt. If he had bought them, things might have been interesting and changed, but a German by the name of Schmidt acquired 3,000 pages again of the teachings of Mani. His Mani and his influence had spread throughout most of the area, from Morocco clear into China, during a century and some centuries that followed, to be branded as heresies by the growing Orthodox Church and finally eliminated to be rediscovered. 3,000 pages of the teaching of Mani. I do not yet have English translations of those to refer you to. Then in Algeria, of all places, they found another book of Mani. It's the oldest book in the world, just recently found. It takes 40 pages to Xerox just the German translation. And when we have that available, we'll get further confirmation of the teachings of Mani. And of course, he and his followers sometimes, not having probably revelation as such, and the power of priesthood and restoration, were trying to go back to early doctrines, early teachings, and he paid for it with his life. Some bizarre material is also included, but the origins of the worlds, eternities, and preexistence, and the Mother and Father in heaven, and many things concerning the temple endowment are found in the discoveries of Mani in Turfan, China, in the areas of Egypt, and in Algeria. And then I'll tell you a little bit now about another one. This one was in Chinese Turkestan, 90 miles south of Turfan. This area was visited by Marco Polo. He went within a few hundred feet of vaults that had been already sealed up for hundreds of years before he even arrived. And he was there 900 years ago. The discovery there in Chinese Turkestan, called today the Caves of the 1,000 Buddhas, the first photographs of the discovery just appeared in the Smithsonian Magazine in May this year. Are any of you familiar with the Smithsonian Magazine? Do you receive this in this area? Did you see the pictures in there? 10-foot stacks of scrolls. This is a picture, probably those of you who nearby can see them. 20,000 scrolls were found in the vaults of the Caves of the 1,000 Buddhas. They stretch for 20 miles when they're unrolled end on end. The first English translations are just now becoming available. Here across the Pamir Mountains in the Taklamakan Desert, the great trade routes, the Buddhists had built into the solid living rock huge grottos covered with paintings and teachings of the ancient mystic things of the Orient. Here was the crossroads between Tibet and Mongolia and China. Almost all of those countries come right together in this great Taklamakan Desert. And here, Ariel Steen made his discovery of the Cave of 1,000 Buddhas. Material included 1st and 2nd century Christian documents, Christian prophecy, how you could detect a prophet on the basis of the Spirit, Mormon doctrine in terms of the edification. One of the things that this brings to mind is that about 28 years ago, the FBI began an investigation of the infiltration of Christian churches on the part of the communists. They assigned a young man and his wife to be agents. And one of the things they were to do in the southwestern part of the United States was to find out how many of the churches had been infiltrated by the communists. And one of the things they found as they pursued that research and that investigation, that nearly every Christian church had been infiltrated by a communist movement, because in the subtleties of doctrine, as they gain leadership, they are able to begin to twist and distort the doctrines of ancient Christianity. Now we read books, Christ isn't really coming. Christ was just a man, things of this kind. But they found there was only one church that the moment someone from the pulpit began to deviate from the accepted doctrines, everybody in the audience felt it, knew it. It amazed them, it surprised them. And this document from Turfan, and then similar document also was found with Mani, but this from Chinese Turkestan, from the Cave of 1,000 Buddhas, explains how the Spirit is the edifying, the control. So when the prophet, President Kimball, speaks, you all know it, you feel it. And that's the key by which this gospel will be able to stand imperishable then in this dispensation. And so Dr. Rees and his wife joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints because they found it was the only church that had somehow a spiritual inbuilt power that no one could infiltrate into its legacy of priesthood and power. without being detected by the very body of the people. So they joined the church. These documents from the first century, second century Christian material include also information how Christ came to set things right that had gone wrong many times before. And I think Christ is occupied with that activity every once in a while, including our own times. In addition to the New Testament material, there was Old Testament documents. And finally, in analysis, as they're cataloging the discoveries of the 20,000 scrolls, and that's not all of them. There are whole vaults, they can't even reach up into them because all of the steps and the narrow ways and everything have been destroyed by erosion and in time. What's still there, they don't know. Some of these are now in the hands of the Japanese and in other scholars. Some are in Cambridge in England. And as they proceed to work on them, those who are informed concerning Mormon doctrine are finding that the ancient gospel basically was the foundation for 52 Buddhist sects, most of the mysticism of ancient Lamaism in Tibet, and Hinduism. Their distortion and finally to the reincarnation cycle is quite evident. But as you pursue these documents, you find much of the restored gospel there. In the Sogdian text that I have right now, here in my hand, one of the first that I've got, in here it discusses most of the contents of the 89th section of the Doctrine and Covenants. A very unusual document. The one that defines for us a law, rather rigorous now, utilized by the saints to define a good health code and their temple preparation. And in here, not just don't drink, but it goes on to say if you don't, you're not going to be weary. It gives a negativism. If you drink, then you're going to faint and things of this kind. Then it even discusses the destroyer. And it's in verse 24 of that 89th section that the destroyer will pass you by if you obey the substance. And so there's too many details to say that it is not a early form of the 89th section Doctrine and Covenants and the Word of Wisdom. There's other things concerning the gods and the kingdoms and the worlds, even the kingdom of a sun, kingdom of a moon, and something like the stars, which we find in our own Doctrine and Covenants and elsewhere. I'm going to move rapidly because there's quite a few things to cover for you. And so what we plan in the future to do is to provide a full tape, one whole hour, on each of these discoveries. I hope that'll be of interest to you in the future. Chinese Turkestan, then, is now becoming slowly available in English. Experts are working upon it. Cataloging will be provided. A whole book on the life of Ariel Steen and his discovery of that marvelous, tremendous library is now being published this summer. And so you'll be hearing more about it. So the purpose of this outline, this hour, is to merely expose you to the name of the discoveries. And so that you will know that when you read these things about Chinese Turkestan or the Cave of the 1,000 Buddhas, that there's something in there that is significant for the Latter-day Saint. Positive proof that Joseph Smith did not conjure up out of his imagination the restored gospel. Now we go to another one in Iraq, in Iran. I've been waiting for 8 years for these documents. This whole week I have been absolutely in a stupor of excitement. I finally received 4 books on Monday. And by the time Friday had rolled around, I was so excited, I was jumping from one book to the other. These are the Mandean books. They were known a little bit. A man by the name of Yu Ting in 1867 had provided some translations of material found in Paris. And then a man by the name of Lesbisky had gone into Iran to trace down some of their origins and found an actual group of people who had been, in all their traditions, part of a first century Christian movement and had retained most of their documents almost intact for nearly 1,900 years. In 1920, he produced some of his texts, and so thrilled a young anthropologist by the name of V.S. Brower, a young lady, that today in her 80s, she's now finishing the translations of nearly a lifetime. 11 years she lived with the people. It's taken almost until now to even get the books. This is one of them. I was just reading yesterday morning when I was flying to San Diego to give a workshop so I could decide what I might include in tonight's activity. Let me read to you just from the first 3 pages as I get into this so you can see whether or not there might be something here of interest. The secret words and the secret name, it's mentioned on one page here. Here it talks about the worlds that were created. A whole doctrine here of the spirit creation found only in the chapters in Moses in the Purgate Price, where it details it, in which there exist the images and counterparts of everything later created on earth. Only one church teaches such a thing, the LDS Church. And yet in the first and second century, These were being taught by Christians and carried over then by groups who were driven out, ostracized, persecuted, and finally, in most instances, completely swallowed up in the world of tyranny. Here it talks about the spirit worlds, even the heavenly fruit on the heavenly tree, the living waters, and the food that is sweet and living and wholesome. And then they take the fruit. Talks about the kings and the sons of kings and how you enter into the kingdom. And over here talks about the two witnesses. And then you will clothe them with a new garment after you've been washed on the forehead, the nose, the ears, the lips, the loins, and the legs. What are they talking about? They talk about the priesthood rite, how they extend the right hand in a special sanctity, and how they pray, O God, hear, and in the name of the great life, hear me. What are they talking about? And over here it talks about how that the church is to take care of everyone from the beginning through to the end, and discusses the Heavenly Mother. And then it discusses how they develop the Sundays, the first day, my day, which is amongst the days. And that's as far as I've got. I don't know what's in the rest of this yet. You can see how exciting that can be. When I was coming down today, this is one of the four books. It's going to take me a few days to get through that one. And again, in here, I'm finding the same thing. I'm finding parallels to the Dead Sea Scrolls. Here's a crown, a wreath. Here is a priesthood garment which involves, and they describe everything clear down to the sash and the sandals. The radiance of light, treasure of eternal life, great is the life, and life be praised. And so these documents then from Mandia are most important. 52 documents have now been made available. This is one of the scrolls. I just received my copy of it. I can give you just maybe a small idea of it. See, these are not small. And when you deal with documents like this, and then as they work with them and translate them, and there's even discussions. You see that circle thing there? It's called a maskna. You know what that is? It's the actual Hebrew origin of temple. And what do they do in there? They perform wedding rites and work for the dead. What are they talking about? We all know. It's exciting. And it's in the Mandean text that we find that a sacrament of bread and water is employed. And recognition of the thousand-year reign of the Christ. The second death is described. Even the baptism by the Spirit of Adam, found only in the Purgate Price. Many, many doctrines. And so we're going to try to get a whole hour collected up as soon as I can finish reading these documents on the Mandean. It even discusses the Urim and Thummim. There's only three different groups that discuss the Urim and Thummim. Its practice, its use, its purpose, and who has it and what it means to possess it. The Book of Mormon and the Book of Mosiah, the Manichaeans found in Chinese Turkestan, and the Mandeans in Iraq and Iran. All three of them on the same absolute basis. What are they talking about again? Yes, they're talking about at different times restoration, powers of priesthood, involvement of individuals who fought for truth and lost. But we're guaranteed there will be no loss in these latter days. Now let's go to another one. Dr. Nibley thinks that this is the most important single discovery concerning the Book of Mormon ever found anywhere. Have you heard of the Archives of Elephantine? Have any of you heard of the Archives of Elephantine? There are two books now available. These were discovered at about the turn of the century. And when we go back in time, and I think some of you as students of Mormonism have read somewhere and know, or at least feel and have heard it discussed, that for some reason or another, if you go back and take 1821 and start with that date, most of the salient, significant additions to the world's knowledge occurs after that. And the Holy Spirit has operated upon the earth, not necessarily among Mormons, but among all men, to give them the things that Abraham and others looked forward to and were denied to even know in depth and detail. And so in our time, we're blessed with an abundance exceeding the wildest dreams of anyone. And things have happened since then. But after 1820, after that great and marvelous, beautiful show of glory with the restitution and restoration of knowledge to the earth, and then Joseph Smith following through, and by the time of his death, 1844, in those 24 years, the restoration was accomplished. Then, following 1844 and the death of the prophet, the world began to make its discoveries to confirm what he had restored. Joseph Smith, in the last years of his life, was writing in diaries. Cather Wood and Stevens had gone on to Guatemala and began to discover the ruins of Quirigua and different places in Guatemala. And Joseph was writing in his diaries. He said, if this isn't Zarahemla, it's sure close to it. And he was excited about those things, and he knew that they were going to confirm everything he had restored. And on page 24, 25, and 27 of the Book of Mormon, he had provided us keys that there would be found in the last days by Gentiles a great avalanche of discovery that would confirm to the world Jesus is the Christ. Now, these discoveries are the trickle. This is the beginning, the preparation, so that scientists, those in academic halls, translators in all these languages, in each of the special areas, and that's what is materializing, you see. A specialist might work well with Coptic or Hebrew in Palestine, but no matter where you move, in what circle you move, there are discoveries being made in those languages, and the Book of Mormon says that he gave to all people sufficient for their needs. And now we're finding in every area, documents are being found that confirm the background of great religious tenets to have been the ancient gospel, as defined by Joseph Smith, in its complexity, in depth and detail. And so a world is being prepared in semantics, words, ideas, and doctrines for the great avalanche to come. And we're promised all these things will come in the future. So we go to the Elephantine archives now, and here we find the life of an ancient Jewish military colony in Egypt at the same time Lehi had moved out of Jerusalem to come here. Lehi commerced with Egypt. On what basis, we don't quite know. But he obtained Egyptian names for his children and for those, and the whole Book of Mormon is filled with a complex of suffixes and prefixes and root words absolutely extraordinary, with double A's, not common to English or the Latin tongues, but rather peculiar, mostly Egyptian, some rather interesting Hebrew variants. And as a consequence, Joseph Smith was considered to have been a very imaginative individual, conjuring up all of those interesting names like Alma and Ponchi and Kib and things of that kind. And he had done a very beautiful job, according to the detractors and the dissidents. And then what do they find? The archives of Elephantine. They found them about the turn of the century, shipped them to the United States. They were lost. The documents were lost for 50 years in a trunk. They showed up in the Bronx just recently, and now they're being translated. Two books are now available. In the Archives of Elephantine, I gave this as a gift to my son for Christmas. I borrowed it, and he hasn't seen it since. And that's not really truthful. We spent an afternoon together when he came back from the university, and he and I, oh, what a marvelous experience to read here about the house of the Lord, using words found only in the Mormon church concerning a temple in an area other than Jerusalem on the great beautiful Isle of the Nile at Elephantine about the time that Lehi was here. This group of individuals actually were in sufficient autonomy that they had their own temple, and they were living a life along the lines that Lehi did, and the confirmation goes beyond that, because here in the Archives of Elephantine, most of the suffixes, prefixes, and the root words in the Book of Mormon are found. Oh, what it was. About every other page as we went along about the archives, looking about the people, just about every page it was a parallel to a Book of Mormon name. And so it was exciting. And I think, let's see, there was about 50 pages of names. Kibda, Jonathan, some were even like Rami, Ramiah. And you hear so many of those in the Book of Mormon. And it showed also that there was a lot of Hebrew words in the Book of Mormon as well, and names. And you're familiar, with, of course, with the fact that the general Yagididin of the Jewish military had found 18 documents in 1962 along the Dead Sea, one of them containing a deed signed by a man called Alma, son of Judah, conveying a deed of land to the Jewish general just before he was killed by the Romans 1900 years ago. And the document was found by the first Jewish general 1900 years later. And he translated sensibly the name Alma. So the archives from Elephantine then are a very important addition. And in the future you'll see and hear more about it. And we'll try to compile an hour of tape which will elicit most of the information we can, background discovery and content. But we just wanted to expose it to you. Dr. Nibley mentions it in his book, Since Cumorah. Lists it as one of the great 27 discoveries made in Palestine and Egypt. Then we go to another one. This is rather exciting. Those of you who are close can see this altar on this Biblical Archaeological magazine here. And those of you behind me can probably see it as well. It's a little place called Tel Arad on the southern part of the Palestinian area near the Dead Sea. Some of you who go to Palestine will pass right by it if you take the trip down to Hebron and go over to Masada. This was excavated not so long ago, but it horrified the experts in Jerusalem because they actually found an altar, and when they brought the experts down and measured the altar was almost exactly like the altar of Solomon, except that the altar and the city and the Brahma, or the sacred place, predated the Temple of Solomon by almost 600-700 years. What was it doing down there? It wasn't even a Jewish city. It got everybody in a rather interesting consternation there for some time, and there's still a little bit of concern on the ministerial level. Dr. Guinat, who knows about Tel Arad, and he knows the Mormon doctrines very plainly, he knows we have the explanation for it. And what is the explanation for Tel Arad? In the 107th section of Doctrine and Covenants, Joseph Smith went historically into a whole series of things concerning the role of the priesthood and its line, clear on back. And there was one particular line that every one of us know about. Where did Moses get his priesthood? He got it from Jethro. There's basic evidences in the book, in the Old Testament, and new books by commentaries working on new documents on the Old Testament. But Jethro had a son, and when the 40 years were over in the desert of Sinai, Moses was ready to go into the land to the north, and he needed a guide to help him. And so Jethro says, I will send you my son Hobab, who knows the northern territory. In fact, he's even got a little domicile up there called Arad. And so sure enough, that's where Hobab left Moses. And Moses went on north to be translated on Mount Nebo. And then Hobab went over to his military communication and his domicile, the city of Arad. And there, being a member of the priesthood, having the priesthood, being the son of a man who had the inheritance of priesthood, he could conduct temple endowments. Then they found another temple and another Brahma, or sacred edifice, and they're still arguing about that. I've got the latest communication in the last 2 weeks. And another one of these altars, this time at a place called Beersheba. This was a place occupied by a man called Abraham, and again goes 800 years back before the time of the Solomon's temple. What was Abraham doing with an altar or a temple? We know because Joseph Smith received the temple endowment when he translated the records from the catacombs of Egypt, Abraham's books. And you can find that evidence in the Pergate Price if you read the facsimiles. Joseph Smith then knew what was going on historically, and of all places you should find a temple, certainly where Abraham was, or where Jethro and his family were, and that's the story of Tel Arad. Now, 5 years ago, they established a branch in Israel, and one of the counselors in that branch is a Hebrew professor, Dr. Twetness. He has prepared already in rough draft an entire study of Tel Arad, and that should be forthcoming sometime in publication, and then that would be made available. And if he doesn't get it out soon enough, then we'll prepare a tape on the details of Tel Arad and go into it and at Beersheba. Then we come to another series of discoveries. Now, these were known about some time ago. In about 1912, there were about 12 books of the pseudo-apigrapha. Now, pseudo means false or unknown, and apigrapha means writing. So that simply means author unknown. Books written by somebody we really can't pin down. Since 1912, they have found another 50 books. And in this, about 2 months from now, in Europe, they're going to have a symposium because there's a struggle going on you just won't believe. A whole series of experts say these books essentially contain pre-Christian doctrines. And then another group of similar experts in other universities, they say they can't possibly contain Christian doctrines because anything that's Christian has been added by a Christian hand after the time of Christ. And so they're having a symposium to see if they're going to accept that the documents are pre-Christ or post-Christ. Because what did the documents contain? Let me read to you a couple of items, and you can see why they're struggling over this. When 5,500 years have been fulfilled, then will come upon the earth the most beloved King Christ. The Book of Mormon calls him Christ and refers to the church and the saints. And if these pseudo-apigrapha turn out to be correct, the Book of Mormon is totally vindicated in those areas of seemingly anachronisms. anachronisms. And the Son of God, to revive the body of Adam with him, to revive the bodies of the dead. He himself, the Son of God, when he comes, will be baptized in the River Jordan. And the Book of Mormon specifically spelled that out. And when he hath come out of the waters of Jordan, then he will anoint from the oil of mercy all that believe in him. And the oil of mercy shall be for generation to generation for those who are ready to be born again of water and the Holy Spirit to life eternal. Then the most beloved Son of God, Christ, descending on earth, shall lead thy father Adam to paradise, to the tree of mercy. Now, if they can prove that that is pre-Christian, you can see what it's going to do. And then another one. And Adam came to Jordan, and he entered into the water, and he plunged himself together into the flood, even to the hairs of his head, while he made supplication to God and sent up prayers to him. You've read that in the Book of Alma, haven't you? And in that time shall men be purified by water from their sins. But those who are unwilling to be purified by water shall be condemned. These come from some of these pseudepigrapha. But there are several of them that are incontestably pre-Christ. This is one of them. Studies on the Testament of Moses. In the Book of Mormon, we have an interesting doctrine that I think there's even a lot of controversy going on among the anti-Mormons in this region and to the south. Moses, in the Old Testament, was taken upon the Mount of Nebo and buried by the Lord. But the Book of Mormon says Alma was translated. Alma was translated like Moses. Moses had been translated. And he came on the Mount of Transfiguration as a translated being. And so we've been looking for evidence that he had been translated. But we go a little bit further. Mormon doctrine says that Moses was foreordained in the preexistence as each of us. He had a preexistence. No Christian churches teaches that. And that he was to be the mediator of the covenant of God, ahead of a dispensation. But there was no evidence of any such thing. And then the whole doctrine of translation is enunciated and defined in our doctrines, in our books, in our teachings. And there's a whole book that was just published on translated beings by a member of the church just a few months ago. So in this particular study of the Testament of Moses, one of the pseudo-apigrapha series now coming out, compiled not only from material found elsewhere, but from material found in the Dead Sea Caves, some of which were deposited 35 years before Christ was born, in jars, sealed up, so the way they could never in any shape or form be said to have been after Christ. So I'm going to read to you just three or four sentences to see if you agree that perhaps here we have interesting confirmation of the most remarkable Mormon doctrine. It's as if written by Moses. Accordingly, he designed and devised me, Moses, and he prepared me before the foundation of the world that I should be the mediator of his covenant. And here's what the translator says. Two claims are made in this passage. The first involving Moses' preexistence, and the second, the claim of Moses' mediating function between God and Israel. He says the claim of Moses' preexistence, of his being created before the world, is as far as I know to be found nowhere else. But we've been teaching it for 146 years. Each of the essential elements of that passage, the foreordination, his preexistence, and his being elected as the mediator of God's covenant. We claim that a prophet today is one who knows God face to face. And so over here it states the author of this ancient text believed that Moses' intercessory role did not end with his natural life. And the special qualification of a prophet like Moses is to have known God face to face and the performance of signs and wonders. And then the last part of the book deals with Moses going upon the mountain. The people follow him, they begin to weep. He's weeping. As he nears the upper part of the mountain, the adversary appears as an angel of light. Where do you find that information? Yes, Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, essentially. And then who thwarts the adversary when he appears? You find it also in the book of the Pearl Great Price and the vision given to Joseph Smith concerning Moses. Michael appears to detect the adversary. In the 128th section of Doctrine and Covenants, the episode is described when the adversary appeared to destroy Joseph Smith. And in the Book of Mormon, when the adversary appeared as an angel light to lead astray the first two generations of Adam and Eve's children. Michael then appears on the mountain, detects the adversary who wants to destroy the body of Moses. It's mentioned even in Jude in the New Testament. What happened there on that mountain? And when the adversary then is thwarted in his purpose, Moses moves up further on the mountain, brings up Joshua, lays hands upon his head and gives him a garment, and proceeds to do certain things with him in the presence of another priest. What happened there? We have a good idea. And then as he nears the end of the top of the mountain, angels appear. He becomes translucent. And then the Lord Jesus Christ appears. And then he's conveyed into the heavens as a translated being. All the confirmation of that Mormon doctrine confirmed in just one single pseudo-apocryphal book, and there's now 52 of them available. So we're looking for that, and we'll be following with great interest what will happen in Europe this fall. Because it's in Alma and in Mosiah and other places, it talks about the land of Jerusalem. It talks about Mary. It refers to Christ by name. All of these things our dissenters have normally said. Joseph Smith, writing in 1829, clearly could have put all of that in. But as we research now and find these ancient doctrines, each essential element found in the Book of Mormon is now being confirmed by uncontestably discovered manuscripts found by non-Mormons, translated by non-Mormons, and brought to the world on that basis. Let's see, there's one, I have a book up here. Here it is. This is my Book of Mormon. Those of you can see all those little tabs. See all those little tabs right there? Each of those tabs is a new discovery confirming that part of the Book of Mormon made in the last 2 years. It takes 30 hours to discuss the new discoveries that confirm the Book of Mormon. And one of them is just this one I was mentioning. In the area where it talks about Mary and the land of Jerusalem, at Tel Amarna, Egypt, a whole series of tablets were discovered concerning the land of Jerusalem, referred to the same way found in the Book of Mormon. And other essential doctrines concerning the kingdoms and glory and things. And the whole Tel Amarna material has never been described for Latter-day Saints, but it's a tremendous discovery. Nibley mentioned it in his book since Cumorah. And so this is one of seven books of Mormons that I use. And I just keep entering the tabs as I go along. Then you see the tabs on the bottom? These are the ones that the dissidents challenge so much. These are the ones that talk about Christ and Mary and saints and church. And we can confirm every bit of that now in a discovery made by a non-Mormon, translated by a non-Mormon. So you want to read your scriptures now. You can read them with confidence and say, hey, this sounds interesting. I'll bet it's confirmed somewhere. And you can be assured it is. We had an 85-student class a month or so ago. I'm on the special faculty of the Y. And you know what we did for 18 hours? We spent nothing but just on new discoveries, 18 hours confirming the 13 pages of the Book of Abraham. 18 hours of new discoveries were so complete, we only spent it on 13 pages of the Book of Abraham. That's how complete. And so that brings us then to another discovery. One of the great ones. In the world of archaeology, this is the one that's got everybody going in all directions. This is the greatest archaeological discovery ever made. And I think you've all heard about it. Have you been reading about Ebla? How many of you have been hearing about Ebla? Tel Mardik at Aleppo. Because Dr. Friedman was down in the area here not so long ago giving lectures on it. One of the leading archaeologists in the world. They're all consumed with the discovery at Ebla. It was in the church, not in the church news, but Desert News, some months back. So I want to tell you a little bit about Ebla. I think we have, unfortunately, those of you way behind there are not going to be able to see this real good. But here are some of the tablets of Ebla. They're 18 inches long, some of them. These are just small palm-sized. And those of you behind, take a quick look there. The material of Ebla took 10 years to recognize and to discover. Italian archaeologists chose a huge, immense mound 20 miles south of Aleppo in Syria along the Euphrates River to decide to dig into. As they began to trench into it, nothing was found much for the first 8 years. Then they found 52 tablets. And as they began to examine those tablets, they were exciting. They realized they had hit another civilization. In fact, the city of Ebla was the capital of an empire greater than the Roman Empire, except it existed 2,500 years before Christ. Nearly all books dealing with the antiquity of religions, background, history, and archaeology are all obsolete. Now, let's start over now. The origins of the alphabet, writings, dictionaries, grammars, and everything, all are obsolete. Everybody's got to start over. All their theories, backgrounds, and ideas are all worth nothing now. They start over. Because there at Ebla, they found in another room another 1,000 tablets. And then in the next room, they found 15,000 tablets. And now they have found 27,000 tablets. And they do not believe they found anything but the annex. They're waiting to find the royal archives. You want to see that? Look at those tablets laying there on the floor. But the LDS individual finds the tablets of Ebla most exciting. There in the facsimile in the pearl great price are names of gods in Mesopotamia. Was Joseph Smith again conjuring up in his mind just names of individuals? gods, anything, Elkanah, Machmerah, he was had some very interesting names there. Now when the tablets of Ebla, the very consonants, the whole construction, and everything of the gods defined by Joseph Smith are confirmed. The individual who ruled in the city of Ebla was a man, or in the city of Ebla was a man by the name of Eber, the third patriarch from the time of Noah. One of the tablets even say the city had not been conquered since the flood. Some of the most direct evidences to the flood, because it was within a year or so, or 100 years or so of the flood itself. Eber ruled in the city with counselors and a quorum of elders and judges defined like they are in the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon says that that information and rule and government came from the brass plates, which was a more sure, complete record clear back to the time of Adam. Joseph Smith again being vindicated in those kinds of statements. Again, in these great tablets of Ebla, it defines the nature of the gods. And what kind of sacrifices did they offer to the gods? Certainly animal sacrifices, but there was a rather interesting, peculiar practice too, bread and wine. Joseph Smith in the Inspired Version had said that the doctrine of the true sacrament had been had in each earlier dispensation, and then he pointed out, Melchizedek being the priest of the Most High God, he brake bread and blessed it, and he gave to Abraham. This was written up by Milton R. Hunter in 1945 in a book called Gospel Through the Ages, and he said for all practical purposes the evidence of the sacrament in earlier dispensations was totally lost. And then the Dead Sea Scrolls 200 years before Christ confirmed the sacrament. Let me read to you one document. The LDS people, I think, will understand this particular one, because in it there are three or four essential Mormon doctrines taught for 146 years. And others again say that Melchizedek was Abraham's ancestor, and he taught Abraham the duty of priesthood, particularly the rules governing the bread and wine, confirming the Inspired Version and doctrines of Joseph Smith. And he also, Melchizedek did, gave Abraham the garments of skin made by God for Adam and Eve. What was he talking about? What does this mean? In fact, all the translator can say, isn't this interesting? And then Abraham builds an altar, and they stand in a circle around the altar, and Abraham raises his hands and says, El, 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 Joel, which means Jehovah, receive the words of my mouth. We know exactly what they're talking about. A non-Mormon will not. And it's exciting then to realize that some of the most intimate and sacred areas of our living and life and our temple work is found confirmed in these ancient discoveries. Ebla also permits us to go into a rather interesting excursion concerning Book of Mormon. And I'll talk about that during the next half hour after we finish these great discoveries. So Ebla then is something for you to watch for. They're digging like mad. They're just working and cataloging now on the different documents. They found that there at that great tell or ruin area, tablets that contained whole dictionaries and grammars. One of them was a grammar and a dictionary of a language they had cracked about 40 or 50 years ago. So they are readily able then from that dictionary to read this ancient Paleo-Canaanitic or early Hebrew. And of course now all the ideas of origins of grammars and dictionaries and writing and everything have to be re-examined in the light of the discoveries. Names like Melchizedek are mentioned in the tablets of Ebla. Who was Melchizedek for sure? These things will raise a whole series of discussions as you can readily understand. And so these tablets casting light on the Old Testament times will, of course, be extremely interesting for scholars, Latter-day Saints, and anyone else who want to deal with the amazement of discoveries being made. And then we can go to another one. And this one was announced just a few weeks ago in Jerusalem, maybe a little longer than that. Sometimes I get to thinking I haven't talked about some of these in one area or not, but I did mention this a little earlier. But this one you should know about because of what it spells out. On page 25 of the Book of Mormon, it states that the non-Mormons are going to find the records concerning Christ. They're going to find sufficient evidence to confirm to the world his reality, his teachings and his doctrines, and the records of the 12 apostles, confirming not only the New Testament and the Old Testament, but the Book of Mormon as well, as a witness to Jesus Christ. I wouldn't hazard a guess where that kind of discovery might start, but could this be one of them? Dr. Falk, a law professor at the Hebrew University, had gone to Cambridge in 1976 because of a series of discoveries that had been made in a synagogue in all places, Cairo, Egypt. A Jewish synagogue had a whole series of documents found in a vault hidden in the back. The discovery was made by Solomon Schechter. Solomon Schechter died from the diseases contracted in trying to unroll and dig out this vault of documents. And he did get quite a bit of work done on it, however, before his death. But others have been left then with the legacy of the documents and the efforts to unravel them, translate them, and find out what they contain. So Dr. Zaviv Falk, a law professor at Hebrew University, photographed the Oriental Jewish document in Cambridge and deciphered it here in Jerusalem last week. So this is back a month or so ago. And Dr. Falk sees in it a possibly new Jewish approach to Jesus' life. Of all times for the Jews to find something concerning Christ in their own synagogue, this is the time, since they started working now with the Jews. The material written in Aramaic resembles no more than a handful of similar writings current during the time of Eastern Jewry in the Near East a long time ago. Among European Jews in the Middle Ages, he notes, there were writings circulating in the community to help refute Christian propaganda. This is interesting. Here was a Jewish background of material where they were able to say to the Christians, you have left so much out that we're not interested. We got more than you got right now. And so they used their material 900 years ago to refute Christian propaganda of their time, because Christianity had lost some very essential things concerning the Christ. Here's what he goes on to say. The document, a single page written on both sides and part of a larger manuscript, reflects Talmudic references to Jesus. That'd be in the first and second century. New Testament information and probably independent Jewish tradition. It takes up the story with the episode of John the Baptist and breaks off with the inquiry among the Jews about the scriptural sources used by Jesus in his preachings. The John story is identical with the version of Josephus, the Jewish historian of the Roman Empire. Josephus had been considered to have been tampered by Christian hands because there was material in Josephus that was strictly and looked apparently to be Christian. But now this confirms Josephus was accurate and had not been tampered with by a Christian hand. The document mentions the emperor Tiberius, and similarly it refers to 11 apostles, though not giving all of them the same names as in the New Testament. Most Jewish sources talk of 5 apostles, Professor Falk pointed out.
Falk notes that the 4 or 5 Oriental Jewish writings on Jesus concentrate on the later period of his life around his crucifixion. The article and the document will be published in the Tarbitz Journal of Jewish Studies. It was found in a Cairo synagogue, a ginzia. The term ginzia was used for the storeroom in a Jewish synagogue where sacred books and scrolls as well as other important writings were kept, instead of being destroyed after their physical condition deteriorated and made them unfit for ordinary use. The famous Cairo Ginzia, part of which is now in Cambridge, contained 200,000 documents.
Since 1945, the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. They contain every book of the Old Testament except the book of Esther in Hebrew, the whole Hebrew canon. They contain every bit of the Old Testament in the Samaritan tradition. They contain most of the Greek tradition of the entire Old Testament. Some of the material goes back to 700 B.C. and shows that there was tampering in some of the documents. It also contains the genealogies of the priests, their offices and callings. It contains 440 books we never knew about before. Today, there's only 5% of the material available. Some of it was suppressed for 12 years. This summer, a whole series of things on the Book of Enoch will be made available. So the Dead Sea Scrolls is another discovery. And then the Nag Hammadi, 1,600 pages, found in 1945 in a jar in Egypt on the Nile River. The ensign had a picture in it a year or two ago this month, 2 years ago. And there at Nag Hammadi are discoveries that confirm everything from intelligences, the doctrine of the mother in heaven, the preexistence, the council of the war in heaven, everything down to the 3 degrees of glory and the kingdom of no glory. Now those are just a series of the discoveries. We've mentioned just some important ones that you'll be hearing about sometime in the future, and which as you go through and study them, you will find overwhelming evidence that the Church of Jesus Christ is, as it claims to be, a restoration of nearly every salient organizational practice, activity, and doctrine. As I explained in today, every little detail concerning the sacrament even, right down to the prayer that is said has now been translated from these ancient documents. The baptismal prayer, a priest making the blessing, bread and water being used, a deacon passing it, the whole ordinance of oil.
and many other of the salient doctrines of the Mormon Church are now found confirmed. We can start with a chart that's 7 feet high, dealing with intelligences, and go clear through onto the 3 degrees of glory and everything in between, and not use one Mormon book to prove all the doctrine. The Church of Jesus Christ is absolutely true, and these things are certainly nice to know. But you still have to get your own salient testimony. Sometime or another in your lives, whatever doubt might creep into your hearts, whatever may be there, you still got to go onto the bended knee of your body and inquire of the Lord, "Oh God, is it really true?" And while we try to stimulate you in these areas that are confirming so much, you must still make that inquiry. You must still get the edification of that Spirit who can give to you an irrevocable testimony. Joseph Smith was a prophet of God. This church is restored as claimed, and Jesus Christ is the Son of God. I know that, and I give you that testimony absolutely in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.